So, the topic of integration and spiritual community. I must say, when I was asked to give this talk a few months ago, I had rather mixed feelings about it. Apart from my natural reticence for giving talks, I realized, going back many years, that this question of integration in the spiritual life has always been a bit problematic in terms of understanding what it means. I've always been a bit confused. What does integration mean? What is it that we're trying to integrate? So I was a bit reticent on that account. But on the other hand, I thought, well, it's a good opportunity for me to think about it and reflect a bit on what does integration mean. The main association I had with the word really was going back to my student days when I was doing engineering, electrical engineering, and I did some sort of quite high-powered maths back then. I couldn't do it now, but of course integration is a very important part of calculus, and so that was my sort of main association with it, really. And I think, as I recall, it seemed to have something to do with adding up all the bits under a graph or something like that. So, yeah, I see some nods from Imogen. Good. At least I got that right. I received an email a week ago or something, probably lots of you did on the Sangha mailing list, promoting something called Vajra Dance. I've no idea what it is. But it said in the blurb to it that it was a way to integrate body, speech and mind. And I thought, what on earth does that mean? To integrate body, speech and mind. So I'm still kind of working at what integration means. Anyway, so we'll see how we go. I've got a few ideas here, and then we'll move on to looking at the connection between integration and spiritual community, if there is such a thing. We'll see about that. So I want to start actually by presenting with you with an image, a metaphor of this boat that's crossing from one shore to another, maybe in a great lake or an ocean. This year when I went to Mexico, I flew for the first time via Canada, Toronto, and when we took off from there, quite soon after that, you cross over one of the Great Lakes. I'd never seen them before, and they really are Great Lakes. Anyway, so I'm sort of picturing something like that, of crossing from one side to another. Anyway, this boat has got some crew and some passengers, quite a number of them, and I'll just mention a few of them. So first of all, there's a captain. There's a bosun or boatswain, who's the officer in charge of equipment and crew. There's, say, the coxswain, who kind of directs the boat or steers it. Then some of the passengers, there's a bit of a dreamer, there's a lover, and there's people like that. Yeah? So there's a number of people on the boat. And they all have their own sort of agenda, what they're there for. They're all supposed to be trying to cross this great lake or ocean, but they're not necessarily cooperating together. So even the captain has his own agenda of where he's going to. He's got in mind this a vision of a desert island somewhere. I don't know if they have desert islands in the Great Lakes, but anyway, so he's kind of heading there. The boatswain is fishing for food off the side of the boat, and occasionally he catches a big shark or something, and it's quite a perilous situation. The coxswain is getting distracted, and he takes the boat in all sorts of different course directions. The lover is playing with the mermaids or the mermen over the side of the boat and leaning perilously, to one side, and it's quite a tricky situation. But somewhere sort of deep in the midriffs of the boat, and nobody knows he's there, but there's a sort of a pilot who's got a compass, and he's more or less keeping the boat on course in spite of all these different kind of people trying to do their own thing. And gradually as they get on their way and begin to make some way across the lake, his presence sort of becomes felt in quite mysterious ways in the end, and they do actually manage to make some progress. So I'll just sort of leave you with that image for the moment. So just coming back to the word integration itself, I did check my dictionary to see what it meant, and it says something like making whole. Yeah, bringing all the aspects of something into a harmonious whole, so that there's no part left out, and that any new part or new element that comes into the situation becomes integrated to form a new whole. Yeah, so integration is something about making whole, bringing together all the different elements of something, the disparate elements, to become something new. And we do talk about an integral whole. So now I just want to present to you a couple of models of what the kinds of things we might be trying to integrate in our lives. And the first thing that comes to mind actually is the five spiritual faculties. You've probably all heard of those, where you've got this sort of mandala of different qualities, different aspects of ourselves. For example, you've got the cognitive intellectual on one side and the emotional faith on the other side. And they can be quite... appear or experience, feel a bit in conflict with each other. So that's two aspects of ourselves that we need to integrate, for example, the intellectual and the emotional, or the reason and emotion, you could say. And then there's another pole is the pole of the inner, the reflective or artistic, creative side of oneself, and the more active, outward, external doing of one's life. Yeah, so there's an example of something that we can work on and integrating. Something a bit more sort of personal is a number of years ago, about 20 years ago or something, I did a little bit of work on sub-personalities. I don't know if any of you have come across this or done any of that sort of work, but in which I began to sort of explore in myself different aspects of my being in terms of actual, as if they are real people, real personalities within me, with their own kind of lives, their own kind of quite distinct lives, and their interests and their ambitions and their fears and their worries and so on, and their moods and all sorts of different things. And I identified a number of them just kind of looking at my own experience. And I've got four in particular I want to mention here. So first of all is what I call Mr. Mature and Responsible. And I call him Mr. MR. So Mr. He's a good sort of person. He works very hard and he cares very much about the situations he's in. He tends to be always on duty, very observant, and just noticing what's going on and noticing what needs to be done, and then tends to respond quite readily to that. So he tends to be kind of quite active most of the time, well, a lot of the time anyway. His downside is that he can tend to be a bit judgmental. So because he's so kind of driven in some ways, or can, you know, care passionately about the situation, he can be a bit critical or even dismissive of those he sees as not kind of, you know, doing enough somehow. So there's him, Mr. Then there's someone who I might call, I don't quite have a name for him yet, but he's a sort of a monk scholar type person. He doesn't like responsibility. He just wants none of it. He likes his quiet time just to be alone, to sit, meditate, reflect, read, study, or just simply do nothing. Yeah. So he's really happy when he can do that. And he can tend to feel squeezed out quite a bit by Mr. And even a bit resentful at times, or at least frustrated. Yeah. So that's the second person I've identified myself here. He tends to kind of be the most explicitly dharmically oriented of them in a way. Well, in a kind of inward sense. Then there's an interesting character who I've called Shady Sam. He's a bit of a kind of a shadowy person. He likes, he likes the night time, the shady side of life. He's quite interesting in like the sort of strange, weird aspects of life. You know, he likes watching the films of David Lynch, for example. And a few weeks ago, Maitri Ghosh and I watched a film called Inland Empire, one of David Lynch's really strange films, and Shady Sam loved it, you know, but he was sort of sitting there, and the monk scholar was just sitting on his behind him, sort of saying, you know, what's this got to do with the Dharma? You know, how do you explain? How do you justify watching this? You know, but it was great. You know, I think Maitri Ghosh enjoyed it as well. Yeah. So he likes sort of weird things in life, the music of Iggy Pop, for example, and the weird side of David Bowie, and the paintings of Hieronymus Bosch, and you know, things like that. Yeah. So he's kind of an interesting character. He's not a bad character, but, you know, he's definitely sort of the strange side of life. And the fourth one I've identified is a young lad, well, a teenager, more or less, who I call Boy Blue. So he's kind of playful and, you know, also doesn't like responsibility much. He tends to be quite shy and quite timid. And he's also very sensitive, very, very sensitive and very easily hurt. So sometimes I find, say, in a meeting at Wintours where I work, in a meeting with, you know, these high-powered adult men who know a lot and are very kind of confident and sure in their ideas and things, that you know, I might make a suggestion and just completely ignored, and Boy Blue just immediately feels, oh, this sort of like he's just been, you know, snubbed quite seriously, you know. So that can be quite a strong aspect of my personality as well. So anyway, there's just a thought about other ways or aspects of oneself that need to be integrated. And I think it's not, I'll just mention this point, that integration I don't think is about kind of becoming a whole in the sense of just becoming a blob, you know, that all these different bits kind of get lose their distinctiveness. It's more like they all kind of grow and transform and change themselves into something else, something more mature or more dharmic in a way, more, yeah. So I think all those different aspects will still be there as I grow and develop. Okay. So that's a little bit about what integration might be. What might need to be integrated. There's probably other models one can use, and probably other ways of expressing that. But they're just a taster, really, of what it might be about. So the question then arose for me. I was thinking about this over the last few weeks about, well, how do we integrate? You know, assuming we even know what needs to be integrated, how do we do it? And I didn't really come up with a clear answer on it. In a way, I realised actually that. As with most things in life, actually with it, as with anything in life, apart from just making things happen in a kind of physical way. For example, if I want to light a candle, I, you know, strike the lighter and apply it to the wick, and it lights. You know, there's quite a direct physical action I can do. But apart from those sorts of things, we can't actually make things happen in life. All we can do really is set up the conditions to make them more likely or more probable to happen. Especially with something as complex and detailed as a human being and our process of spiritual development. So these things I'm suggesting are not kind of a formula in the sense of you do this, it'll have such and such direct result. It's more like setting up these conditions and more likely that integration is going to happen. So the first condition I think is necessary, and it's absolutely essential, is mindfulness or awareness. You could say it's the royal road to integration. And I do find Bhante's four dimensions of mindfulness or awareness very useful here. And I think particularly, the first one about awareness of self is very, very important in terms of becoming integrated. And particularly importance of awareness of the body or experience of the body through mindfulness. I think we in the West tend to think of the mind as being somehow in the head, but actually that's not really a Buddhist view. It's interesting when we go Om Ah Hung, we're saying body, speech and mind. So in Buddhism, the mind is very much associated with being located in the body. And when I'm using the word mind, I mean in quite a broad sense of the word, including sensations, feelings, emotions, thoughts, intuitions, dreams, you know, memories and so on. So it's that all comes under the term mind. So that we can experience all that in our body and through our physical experience. It manifests itself in the body. So I really want to emphasize the importance of being mindful of the body, mindful of the mind in the body. So when I say body, I'm not talking about it just as a physical object. Secondly, mindfulness is more than just kind of being aware in the sense of not going around bumping into things, or not just about remembering where you put your glasses or your wallet or your passport, and not forgetting appointments with people and so on. Those are all really important, but I think mindfulness is much more than that. Some time ago, I had some really quite sort of painful emotions and went through quite a difficult period emotionally. And I found that the best way of dealing with it really was to just get deeply into my experience, well, as deeply as possible, and experiencing that, you know, kind of in sensationally in my body, and not reacting to it, or at least kind of just allowing it to be there, whatever it was. And that was the most effective thing I could do, really. Yeah, so experiencing ourselves more deeply, more truly, more fully is what mindfulness is about, really. And in that way, kind of getting to know ourselves, getting to know what's going on there. Just a little bit more about the body. I find it really interesting that when one is learning a new skill, it's really when it kind of gets into the body, into our being, that we've remembered it, really. And just a few examples from my own experience, like learning a new language, for example. To begin with, you kind of have to really remember consciously the vocabulary and the grammatical points and so on. You do use your head, as it were, your intellect, to kind of, you know, actually have a go at speaking. But gradually over time, it seems to kind of get in somewhere, and you just, well, as I am in English, you know, it just sort of comes out, and I don't know where it comes from. I remember speaking Spanish at one point, and after a couple of years or something, and I just realized, where's that coming from? You know, how did I? And I wasn't sort of actually consciously trying to think of the words, so it just sort of came out. So that's an example of how, you know, learning a new skill gets into the body. Similarly with doing, I learned a bit of Tai Chi, and I find now if I try to, you know, consciously think about the movements, I can't really do it. But if I just allow the body to move, then it knows somehow. Yeah. Or I sing in a choir without a city, and you know, learning a new song can take some time. And to begin with, I have to be quite conscious about, you know, which note to sing and how to sing it and so on. And it's quite a deliberately conscious effort. But after a while, it just sort of comes out quite naturally. Yeah. Couple of interesting things also about the body. Recently, well, as we know, Arta Priya had a heart bypass operation, and he told us in our chapter that he was told that when they do it, they have two options. One is they can just keep the heart pumping and somehow work around it while it's still going, and that seems to be the preferred option. But sometimes they actually stop the heart and use an artificial sort of pump of some kind to keep everything pumping. And he told us, I think you could confirm this, that if I get it right, that when they do that often, they're told that people lose their memory or lose certain aspects of their memory. So it's very interesting that just stopping the heart for a few minutes or whatever long, an hour or two, you actually lose some memory. Yeah. Because usually we think of memory as being something stored in the brain, but who knows? Yeah. Similarly, I've heard that, you know, when people take on a donated organ from somebody else, that often they get memories from that other person, you know, through the organ that they've taken on. Very mysterious sort of thing. So I think the body is very, very mysterious and well worth being mindful of. Obviously. I'll say a little bit about other people later on, and yeah, I won't say much more about being aware of nature and the environment, though that's really important, and aware of reality as well, which is really just being aware of these other three aspects or dimensions of mindfulness, but from the point of view of you know, what in a way what's really going on there. A second great condition, I think, for the development of integration is the practice of ethics. So ethical behavior and integration, I think, is very, very important. Because I think unethical behavior tends to disintegrate us. It's also a manifestation of unintegration. Actually, my spell check and my dictionary say the word unintegration doesn't exist, but I want to use it. So when we're in an unintegrated state, then we tend to behave in unethical ways. And I think it's because when we're in a disintegrated or unintegrated state, we're acting or behaving from a small or limited part of ourselves, not from our wholeness. So when we're in a state of craving, for example, or hatred, we're quite strongly identifying with that small part of ourselves, and it seems to take over, and it makes itself felt or seem as if it is the whole of ourselves, at least while we're in that state. Yeah. So I think that the unethical behavior and unintegration or disintegration are one and the same thing, really. I find when I'm in a state of strong craving, for example, it's almost like I'm under a spell, and that the rest of me I just lose touch with somehow, you know. So I'll just give some examples now of disintegration. And I think we can tend to be different people at different times. So when we're not yet developed very much, we can tend to identify with certain aspects of ourselves overly at that time. And for example, one person of ourselves might make a decision to do something, but when the time comes to carry out the decision, maybe there's another person there, and that person says, "Sorry, no, I didn't make the decision. I don't feel like it. I don't want to do it." Yeah. So you can quite easily let people down in that sort of way by being through, you know, unintegrated. So I think that's a very important thing, to have enough breadth of awareness of oneself to be able to really carry through one's decisions or even promises. Bunty makes quite a point of this, really. He says that he's very cautious about making promises, because especially when he has to depend on other people or other conditions to be able to carry them out. So he's very, very strong about following through his promises if he makes a promise. So I think a sign of integration is when someone can follow through their commitments or their promises or decisions that they've made. I'll just give a couple of examples of rather extreme disintegration from a couple of films that I've seen. One was a film called Secret Window. I don't know if anyone's seen that, with Johnny Depp. I saw it about 10 years ago or something. It's quite interesting. He plays this character who's a writer, an author, and he goes to a house in a forest, so just to be alone to write some book. And he gets visited by this very strange sort of character, comes and knocks on the door. Quite different from him, tall and not very good looking and so on. And throughout the film, this character turns up every now and then in different situations, and is quite sort of menacing and threatening. Quite an unpleasant sort of character. And towards the end of the film, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to give it away, but just otherwise I can't make my point. But this other character actually kills one or two people, I think it is, at least something like that. So, you know, he's obviously very, very bad. And it turns out that this guy is actually an aspect of the Johnny Depp character himself. He's an aspect of his psyche that he was completely alienated from. It's an example of a complete disintegration within a person. Another film I was reminded of was last year, seeing the film Blue Jasmine, with the Woody Allen film, with Kate Blanchett, who brilliantly plays this woman who had been rather unethical earlier in her life and continued to be so in a sense, and her life just went through this process of disintegration, and she ends up at the end of it, poor woman, just in a complete state of disintegration, really, in a very, very bad way. So they're just a couple of examples of I remember also I know an older member whose whose father got in quite a bad way for quite a lot of the latter part of his life. He had been a professional man, holding down a really good job, a wife and family and so on. And at some point, I think his wife left him or something, and his life just crumbled. You know, so he became an alcoholic and just couldn't work and so on. And yeah, just through that single event in his life, yeah. So I think acting from a more integrated being, a more whole being, is acting from a position of more choice and freedom and more strength, actually. The more integrated we are, the more choice and freedom we have in our lives to direct our lives in the way we'd like to go, rather than being kind of, you know, if we're unintegrated and just acting out of quite a small part of ourselves, it's not so helpful. I remember on conventions, this happens to me sometimes, that order conventions, I can get quite inspired and you know, hearing the talks and so on. I'm meeting up with my preceptor Sabuti sometimes, perhaps, and you know, he's really, really inspiring. And I remember on those occasions how there's this part of me that really wants to take on the world can feel really sort of positive and confident. Like, you know, and I come to the view, right, next year or next week I'm going to China and I'm going to set up Triyatna in China sort of thing, and it feels like I can sort of take on the world, you know, but I've come to realize it's actually just an example of not being fully integrated, that, you know, I get back to work the next week and, you know, I've got a mountain of things to do and I'm in quite a different state. Yeah, well, although I don't forget it necessarily. Just a word here on the word integrity, which is obviously closely related to integration and becoming integrated. I looked it up in the dictionary, and the secondary meaning means the state of being whole and undivided. So that my dictionary gives that as the secondary meaning. The state of being whole and undivided. So you might talk about the integrity of the data in the computer system or something, or... I wrote here that the UK has stronger integrity by Scotland remaining in the Union. Discuss. Yeah. Okay. But the primary meaning actually is the quality of being honest and having strong moral principles. So in the word integrity, we get the strong connection with ethical life, ethical practice. Yeah. And Sabuti talks about in his paper Initiation into a New Life that we take responsibility for the effect that we have on our own mind and on the world around us. Yes, so taking responsibility. This, he's talking about this under the question of integration, by the way. It's very much working with the karmic kind of conditionality. Yes. So, becoming integrated is very much around the area of ethical practice, ethical life. The third thing I thought about, kind of coming out of those two, of mindfulness and ethical behaviour, is that can lead us into dhyanic states, and it's interesting that Bhante talks about the first dhyana as being the stage of integration. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the simile of the soap powder and the water being perfectly blended together as a kind of simile for integration. Yeah. And I was having a chat with Priyananda about this, and because this is a plug for Wintour's publications, but next year there's going to be coming out a book by Sabuti from his 2001 talks about the mind and mental events. Sort of companion volume to Bhante's Know Your Mind. Anyway, he was talking about how positive mental events seem to be fewer in number and more, in a way, more simple. So I think when we're in deeper or higher meditative states or more positive states, life is kind of more simple. It's not so complex. And I do find this with myself, that you know, when I'm in a kind of difficult state and there's lots of issues going on and that, and I'm not feeling terribly integrated, life can feel very complex, very complicated. And I notice this in other people too. You know, you see someone with an issue and you sort of kind of talk with them about it and maybe suggest something, and they say, oh, well, I couldn't do that because of this. And then what about doing this? Oh, no, you couldn't because... So, you know, I think we can be very, very complex when we're in an unintegrated state. But life can be so much more simple and less complex, I think, when we're in really positive states. And I think that's exemplified in, like, when you get in dhyana. Because I think when you resolve these conflicts, which is what the whole process of preeti is about, really. It's kind of resolving all the tensions and energy tied up in negative emotions and conflicts in being an integrated person. Okay. Another thing as a part of the process of integration is to transform ourselves. We need, I think, to put ourselves at the service of something higher. In our case, it would be the Dharma practice in our own particular ways that we do it. We need a vision of something that's worth striving for, something we really believe in, something that's very precious to us, and which, you know, we want to put a lot of energy into. And I think this can have quite a strongly integrating effect on us. We need intensity, basically. It's almost like we need a crucible, a situation that we really care about, that we can really put ourselves into. And doing that with other Dharma friends is a very sort of valuable way or very powerful way of transforming ourselves, of integrating ourselves. Because I think something out of a situation like that, something new can arise, a new wholeness can emerge from the kind of the tensions and so on in our being, basically. I do find that myself. You know, sometimes I've got what feels like quite a lot to do, and they're all really important things to me, and I don't feel that I can kind of not do any of them somehow, or there's none of them I could not do. So I almost like I need to draw something out of myself to become a bigger person in order to be able to do what's really, really valuable to me. Yeah. Okay. Just before I go on to spiritual community more specifically, I just want to mention in this relation about something, a vision that we're moving towards, the importance of beauty, the importance of something having something really attractive that we're drawn to, something that is self-transcending. And I was on retreat at Adhisthana in May with Subhuti and Padmavajra on the retreat of Eros and Beauty. And Subhuti made the point that he thinks we can't really see the other lakshanas, that is dukkha, anicca, and anatman, unless we can see shubha, that is, unless we can really see beauty. It's almost as though we can't really see reality unless there's something really attractive and beautiful for us to be kind of growing into that we can really believe in somehow. And finally, I think it's only insight that can guarantee that we won't disintegrate again. So we might get, you know, we might be mindful, ethical, get into dhyana and so on, be working with others and so on. But unless we actually carry on and continue until we gain insight into the nature of reality, there's always a chance of falling back. And I'm doing reading Othello at the moment, the Shakespeare play, as part of an online Shakespeare course that I'm doing at the moment. And I'm just sort of discovering that I don't really know the play well, but I'm getting to know that at the beginning of the play, well, Othello is a very noble, a very responsible sort of person, character. He's a general in the army, in the Venetian army, and he's married to a very beautiful, pure, loving, kind woman called Desdemona. And but he comes under the influence of, so he's quite apparently quite an integrated sort of person at the beginning of the play. But but through the course of the play, he comes under the influence of a very evil character called Iago. And gradually you could see this disintegration process going on in him. Presumably he hasn't gained insight. And you know, ends up actually killing this his wife, you know, the most precious and wonderful person in his life. Yeah. So it's kind of an example of someone who starts off apparently quite integrated and gradually just goes through this process of severe disintegration. So, where are we going? Okay. On to spiritual community. I'll just remind you of a couple of probably quite basic points about it, and remind you of the Bhante's very, I think, very important teaching about on perhaps a lower level. You've got the group and the group members and the individualist. So the individualist is in reaction to the group. He or she doesn't identifies themselves as not being part of the group, basically. Yeah, and group members are not really individual in the full sense of the term. So they think the same, they wear the same clothes, they vote for the same party and so on. Those sorts of things, yeah. So, but then on a higher level, you've got what Bhante calls the true individual, a person who is self-aware, positive, responsible, objective and so on. Yeah, someone who has really become quite integrated. And more or less at the same level, you've got the spiritual community, which is people who, well, individuals relating together as friends, basically. So I'm presenting a little bit idealized there, that it's a bit simplistically, but of what the spiritual community is. It's been said that it's a free association of individuals in this sense. So in order to have a spiritual community, you really need to have integrated individuals. We cannot have a spiritual community without integrated individuals, or at least individuals who are becoming integrated, who are integrating themselves. Bhante does talk about having a kind of an intermediate group called the positive group, between the group in the sense I mentioned before and the spiritual community. And you know, that's what we're, you know, trying to develop here at the Buddhist Center, you could say. And we could call that a spiritual community in the broadest sense of the term. Yeah, not quite the full sense that I mentioned there. Yeah, so spiritual community is a network of people relating to each other on the basis of friendship. Yeah, so it's a free association of individuals, of friends, really. So I want to talk a little bit about friendship at this stage, and its importance in spiritual community and in integration. And I use the word friendship in two senses, in a narrow sense and also in a more broad sense. So in a narrow sense, I'm talking about it in as the relationship between two people, which is based on maitri. There's a mutual liking of each other, some common interests, though areas of difference as well. There's a taking delight. Bhante says taking delight in the friend is a really important aspect of friendship. Spending time together, perhaps quite a lot of time, especially in the early stages of the friendship. There's kindness, awareness of each other. It's a relationship based on not on self-interest. It's objective, and it's quite strong positive feelings of maitri. Dr. Johnson defines it as one joined to another in mutual benevolence and intimacy. Intimacy in this context meaning that you're just very free to just be yourself completely with your friend. Yeah. So that's friendship in the narrow sense, just a relationship between two people as friends. And obviously in our Dharma lives, that friendship is very, very important, and it's something that we want to cultivate as much as possible. In the broad sense, you could say that friendship is an element that can come into other relationships that we have in our lives. For example, relationship with parents, or with children, or with our partner, or spouse, or work colleagues, schoolmates, sportsmates, and so on. Yeah, and these relationships are very important relationships in our lives, but often they're mixed with all sorts of other needs and wants and so on. And friendship is not necessarily a strong element of it, but it can be. And I think, especially if we're aware as Dharma practitioners, we can bring the element of friendship into these relationships as much as possible as well. To some extent, we can even transform these relationships into friendships, though very often they'll have, quite strong elements of other sort of dynamics going on. Okay. So I've been saying a little bit about kind of relationship between integration and friendship or spiritual community, but I just want to read you a quote here from Carl Jung, which I think makes it very clear what he thinks about relatedness to people. So he says, "The self is relatedness. The self doesn't exist without relationship. Only when the self mirrors itself in so many mirrors does it really exist. Then it has roots. You can never come to yourself by building a meditation hut on the top of Mount Everest. You will only be visited by your ghosts, and that is not individuation. You are all alone with yourself, and the self doesn't exist. Not that you are, but that you do is the self. The self appears in your deeds, and your deeds always mean relationship." Yeah, so that's what Jung was saying about being in relationship. So in a way, he's saying that the self doesn't really exist. It's only through our relationships with each other that we kind of become somebody, in a sense. I mean, I don't want to push it too far, but it's a very strong sort of thought, really. So there's something in that for me about the importance of Sangha, spiritual community, and becoming integrated, that it's through our relationships with people that we really get to know each other, know ourselves, and, of course, other people, and thereby grow and develop. Yeah, so forming Sangha, or spiritual community, is a very, very important and powerful way to become integrated in oneself through cooperation with others. That we become more spiritually developed through our friendships with others. Because it's a relationship, as I said, based in Maitri, very often working together on a common project, living together or cooperating, sharing our lives with others. We really come up against each other and thereby this can have a very strong effect on oneself. But in a way, sort of, why friendship? How does this happen? I mean, you know, how does developing friendship have an integrating effect on one? How do we get to know ourselves through our relationships with others? Well, I think it's really because in friendship, it's the relationship in which we can most truly be ourselves, truly be most open, most honest, revealing, exploring different aspects of ourselves and our friend. Yeah, because I think our friend doesn't have a sort of vested interest in us being anyone other than ourselves. You know, our friend doesn't need us to be somebody else. Our friend wants us to be who we are, to be authentic, to be real. He or she wants to get to know us as we really are. I think it's quite common that parents want to try to live out their lives through their children, for example. They have quite strong expectations that their children turn out a certain way. Children also need their parents to be a certain kind of people very often. Just a week ago, Maitri Ghosh and I and Pedro, we went to see a play at the ADC Theatre, a very good play called All My Sons by Arthur Miller. And in the play, at some point in the play, the son, who's an adult man at that stage, discovers certain things about his father, and he's very distraught. It's a very, very painful situation for him, you know, to discover that his father is not who he thought he was or wanted him to be. Yeah, so very often in these other kinds of relationships, there's a very strong need for the person to be a certain way. Yeah. Okay. Whereas with our friend, you know, in a really good friendship, that our friend wants us to change, wants us to develop and grow, wants us to become integrated, to be authentic and to awaken. If you're both on a Dharma path together, then that's what you both most want for each other. So you're very encouraging of that, encouraging of both of you becoming who you can really be, who you are in your, essentially. And I just want to mention, say something, get a plug here for this theme of eros and beauty, which is going on a bit this year. I've used the word Maitri, and maybe the word Maitri or Metta doesn't necessarily have really strong connotations for us. You know, yeah, we believe in it, we think it's great, and so on. And we practice the Metta Bhavana, you know. But I just want to use the word love. You know, I think we need to love our friends, you know, even passionately. You know, I'd like to say that I love my dozen or so close friends, won't mention names. You know, I love Subhuti, my preceptor. I love Bhante. A few weeks ago, we had a men's mitra morning here in which we explored Bhante and his relationship to the order and the movement and so on, and his place in the Buddhist world and that. And we watched a little film that Pedro had made about Bhante, and I was in tears just watching this very lovely film, of a little short film about Bhante. And I'd never felt so much love for Bhante as I did in that, watching that film here. So I think, you know, I don't think we should be afraid to love our friends. And yeah. Okay, I've got a quote here from, just a couple of quotes about love. One is from Lao Tzu, the ancient Chinese sage, who said that he who defends with love will be secure. Heaven will save him and protect him with love. So I think it's just, well, for me, saying something about if you love, then you'll receive love and receive protection as well. And a quote from Khalil Gibran. It's more like a poem, actually, than a... But anyway, I quite liked it. So he says, love has no other desire but to fulfill itself, to melt and be like a running brook that sings its melody to the night, to wake at dawn with a winged heart and give thanks for another day of loving. Yeah, quite like that. Yeah, so I think, you know, just loving our friends is really, really important. Loving our friends in the sangha, in the spiritual community. I think I said this before, but I'll just emphasize it, that a spiritual community can only consist of integrated individuals. The spiritual community depends on there being integrated individuals. So if we really want to form a spiritual community, we need to be integrating ourselves. Back in the old days when I was first coming along, we used to talk quite a lot in terms of commitment to the three jewels, commitment to the Dharma life. I think it was a term that Bhante used quite a lot. We can't really commit ourselves unless we're an individual. So unless we're integrated enough to be able to have enough of ourselves behind our commitment. Yes, so integration is necessary for commitment, and commitment is necessary for forming spiritual community, or forming part of a spiritual community. Okay, almost finished. Just in case you're getting an idea that Dharma life or Dharma practice is all about just spending lots of time with people all the time. I think we can get that impression sometimes with Tri Ratna. And I think it's a bit misleading. That is very important, and I've been stressing that. But I think it's also important to, in terms of integrating oneself, becoming oneself more deeply and fully, that one does spend time in solitary activity, solitary retreats. Bhante has said that every order member should do a solitary retreat, I think he said of a month each year. So, you know, he's really stressed the importance of solitary time as well. Solitary time to reflect, for example, or just to pursue creative artistic pursuits or something, whatever it might be. Yeah. So I think this is also a really important aspect of becoming integrated. So I don't want to kind of give a wrong impression that it's all about just spending time with people all the time. Okay. So to conclude and recap slightly, I've mentioned that we need to become mindful, aware, that we need to be ethical, practice ethics very strongly, that we need deeper meditative experience. Almost above all, we need a strong spiritual friendship with other people, other friends, other Dharma friends. That's really, really important. And we need participation in our personal interest and for example, in the arts, for example, or other personal pursuits. But all this can seem quite a long and involved and even confusing process, and sometimes you wonder whether you're making any progress or, you know, whether you're getting anywhere. And I've got a quote from Schopenhauer, the great German philosopher, which he said, and it suggests that he had made some progress in becoming integrated, because I think what he's saying here doesn't necessarily happen automatically. But he said, when you look back on your life, it looks as though it has followed a plot. But when you're in it, it's just a mess. It's just one surprise after another. Yeah? But then later on, when you look back, it seems it was perfect. Yeah? So I just say that as kind of giving us encouragement to keep at it, you know, and that you can see a sort of a pattern emerging in your life as you continue to practice the Dharma over some time. And just to finish off, I want to say that I think if we keep on growing, developing and becoming more integrated, more fully rounded human beings, developing insight into the nature of reality and so on, we may eventually find ourselves in the company of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And I just say that because I think the assembly of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is a spiritual community at the very highest level. Yeah? It's the spiritual community par excellence, we could say. And it consists of fully integrated individuals. So it's a perfectly integrated spiritual community, and it's consisting of perfectly integrated individuals. And you could look at the mandala of the five Buddhas as both the perfectly integrated mind, that is the human mind, developed, integrated, perfected, and expressed in this form of the mandala of the five Buddhas. Yeah, that's the human mind, fully and perfectly integrated. But you could also see it as the perfectly integrated spiritual community, that those five Buddhas are themselves a spiritual community. And maybe at that level, the distinction between the individual and spiritual community dissolves and breaks down, and actually you just have, there's not really a distinction at the highest level, that they're not two distinct things. So I think I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.